ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening. Welcome to PM. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, the family of Alice Springs' five-year-old Kumanjai little baby calls for calm after rioting in the outback town last night. Also, can Benjamin Netanyahu hold on to power at Israel's next election? And the future of LIV Golf in doubt after Saudi Arabia pulls the plug on funding.
It might be a smaller league where people go to the golf for different reasons, to drink a lot and throw cups at players when they hit a hole in one. But it will never rival the traditional format of the game in the way that was intended.
Community leaders and police in Alice Springs are calling for calm after last night's riot. Hundreds of people gathered outside the town's hospital after hearing that Jefferson Lewis, who'd been arrested in relation to the murder of a five-year-old girl, had been taken there. Many in the group wanted police to hand Lewis to them to be dealt with by the community. The family of the murdered girl have appealed for the violence to end to allow them to mourn. Jane Barden reports.
Police drove back a crowd of more than 400 people trying to storm the Alice Springs hospital last night by firing rubber bullets and tear gas. The crowd smashed up cars and threw rocks and bottles. They demanded officers give them 47-year-old Jefferson Lewis. The police arrested Mr. Lewis at about 10:30 on Thursday night following the alleged murder of a five-year-old girl, Kumanjai Little Baby. Her body was found yesterday afternoon near the Old Timers Town Camp, near where she and Mr. Lewis disappeared on Saturday night. Police say her mother had gone to the house to do her laundry and put the child to bed there while a drinking party was being held. After a huge five-day search, Mr. Lewis was found at another town camp, Charles Creek, last night. Police intervened after he was beaten unconscious by an angry crowd of 200 people. A bigger crowd formed outside the hospital after the police brought him there, including relatives of Kumanjai Little Baby.
That's my little cousin sister. I am angry about Jefferson Lewis for my young little cousin.
Some there, including Harley Myers, accused the police of unfairly protecting Mr. Lewis from traditional Aboriginal justice.
We're all sad, we're all hurt. The feeling that they're protecting this guy and shooting us with rubber bullets and shooting us and all that. And it's like the system's not sticking up for us. Let us get our traditional payback, walk all over us with our laws and culture, you know.
NT Police Commissioner Martin Dole condemned the violence. He called for calm and for the legal system to be allowed to work.
The behaviour that we saw last night cannot be explained away, excused or accepted. So for those people involved, you will face the law just as Jefferson Lewis is facing the law.
Kumanjai Little Baby's family have also appealed for the violence to stop. Her grandfather, Walpree Elder Robin Japananka Granitz, released a statement saying, "Of course my family is feeling angry and hurt, but this man has been caught and we must now let justice take its course while we take time to mourn." Warren Williams Japananka is another of her grandfathers and chairman of the Central Land Council.
At the moment I feel devastated by what happened all this week and losing our grandchild was enormous.
Warren Williams says the many floral tributes to her placed around the town have touched his family. He's also called for an end to the violence.
Things like this, which happened at the hospital last night, is not tolerated. Police are here to protect people and we've got to go by that rule.
And he's appealed to Indigenous families coming into Alice Springs to always keep their kids close.
When you're in town or coming into town to do shopping, be aware that you've got children around you and keep an eye out all the time. Otherwise, you never know what's prowling around you.
Alice Springs Al-Yawarra community leader Michael Little, who runs prisoner behaviour change programs, added his voice to calls for calm.
The community of Alice Springs come together searching for a little baby that was taken. And that hard work was undone last night.
The NT Chief Minister, Leah Fenocchiaru, has responded by closing Alice Springs bottle shops today. Takeaway alcohol is already banned in the town on Monday and Tuesdays since rioting and a crime spike in 2023.
It's very, very important and will bring important reprieve to the community and our frontline workers. Tomorrow there will be limited takeaway between 11 and 2 p.m.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, called on the Alice Springs community to come together.
We certainly understand people's anger and frustration that was expressed, but we want the community to come together.
Al-Yawarra leader Michael Little says her death has stirred up anger within many Alice Springs people who've suffered similar trauma in their own families that's never properly been addressed.
I just hope that people recognise that there's a lot of anger there, and it's caused by something else happening around in these people's lives about traumatic experiences. And the ability to act out violence linked with that anger is something that needs to be addressed at the moment, and it's not being done very well.
Alice Springs community leader Michael Little ending Jane Barden's report. The death of Kumanjai Little Baby has led to a discussion about the safety of Alice Springs town camps. Liberal Senator for the NT, Jacinta Nampajimpa-Price, is calling for an independent inquiry into how the small communities on the outskirts of Alice Springs are governed, a call which has won the support of opposition leader Angus Taylor. But as Oliver Gordon reports, not everyone in Alice Springs believes an inquiry is the answer.
Alice Springs woman Barb Shaw has lived in town camps for more than 50 years.
If I was to describe a town camp to a person, it is little pockets of family communal living areas.
There are 16 Aboriginal town camps on the fringes of Alice Springs, forming a series of little villages. With the communities in the national spotlight due to the horrors of the last few days, Barb Shaw is speaking up for those who live in them.
Town camps are not dangerous. It's the people that are dangerous.
Today, NT Senator Jacinta Price has written an opinion piece in the Australian newspaper saying an independent inquiry into the way town camps are governed and maintained should be on the table following the death of Kumanjai Little Baby, who was staying in a town camp when she was allegedly abducted. Barb Shaw doesn't see that as the right response.
That shouldn't call for an inquiry. What Aboriginal people have been calling for a very long time is an inquiry into the services and funding that's been put into service providing organisations into the territory. The system, government systems, always seem to fail Aboriginal people. It doesn't matter what age you are. But unfortunately, we do have ugly, evil monsters in society. And it doesn't matter what colour you are, what background you come from, that monster is always going to hurt somebody.
Opposition leader Angus Taylor has backed Senator Price's calls for a closer look at town camps.
It's the denial that has led us to this place where people aren't prepared to have honest conversations about the state of affairs in our town camps and what options there are to address it.
But Minister for Indigenous Australians, Malandiri McCarthy, says now's not the time for that conversation.
And now's the time to come together as a community in sorry business and be with this mum and her son as they prepare to bury their daughter.
The idea that it's too early to call for an inquiry, backed up by NT opposition leader Selena Yubo too.
It's just gone over 24 hours since we learned of the horrific and devastating death of Kumanjai Little Baby in Alice Springs, and I think the focus really does have to be on supporting the family in the immediate. I think there's time and space for those bigger conversations and discussions.
She'd like to see the discussion shift to one about the justice system.
How do we prevent any such incidents in the future, but also how are we going to invest in justice here in the Northern Territory to be better, to make sure that it's actually serving its purpose, that it is a fit-for-purpose system here in the Northern Territory.
Macquarie University criminologist Dr. Vince Hurley says those who've served their sentences should be monitored.
Because they've been institutionalised their day from Monday to Friday, 365 days of the year, their life has been regimented by a system that holds them to account And then all of a sudden, they're let out on the street, not to held account for anyone. So going from one extreme of lifestyle in custody to another. And it's, you know, it's bound to cause dramas if there is no support.
Dr. Hurley says while there will be elders in town camps hesitant to make changes or invite inquiries, safety needs to be prioritised.
You know, it's going to take understanding and tolerance and patience, but at the end of the day, whatever done is to protect, you know, young children and women from horrendous violence.
Whichever approach is taken, town camper Barb Shaw is today remembering Kumanjai Little Baby.
She was somebody's daughter. She was somebody's granddaughter, somebody's niece, someone's sister. She had a skin name. She had a mother and father, four grandparents.
That's Alice Springs town camper Barb Shaw, Oliver Gordon reporting. And if this story has raised any issues for Torres Strait Islander or Aboriginal listeners, you can contact 13 Yarn on 139276 or visit the website 13yarn.org.au. Lifeline is also available on 13 11 14. This is PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. Overseas now, and two of Israel's former prime ministers are joining forces in an attempt to oust the current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from office in Israel's national elections later this year. Centrist opposition leader Yair Lapid and the far-right's Naftali Bennett have paired up to defeat Prime Minister Netanyahu once before. Can they do it again this time? Lahav Harkov is an Israeli journalist. She joined me earlier. Lahav Harkov, these two men have hailed this move as the first step in the process of uniting and repairing the state of Israel. Is this a realistic challenge they're mounting?
It is a realistic challenge to Prime Minister Netanyahu. I mean, whether they're going to actually unite Israel or not, I think is a broader societal question, but I think they have a chance. Six different Israeli media outlets I saw put out polls. The immediate polling still shows a sort of inconclusive result. The election is 6 months away, so of course we don't know who's going to win. But in most cases, you still have sort of the pro-Netanyahu camp and the much of the anti-Netanyahu camp that would likely form a coalition. Neither side is getting a majority yet, so things are very much in play.
Lapid is a centrist. Naftali Bennett is a right-winger. Can they make their differences work?
So Lapid and Bennett, first of all, have a history of working really well together in 2013 to 2015 and also in 2021 to 2022. And they're very clearly friends, first of all, and people who trust each other very much. And I also just think they don't have such huge policy differences between them on most issues at this point. Bennett has moved more to the center on a lot of the domestic issues that concern Israel. And Lapid, like many Israelis, has moved to the right on national security issues. They still differ on the issue of Palestinian settlements, two-state solution. But from what I hear, you know, when reporting on this, is that on both sides, they feel like it's not the imminent issue right now.
You spoke briefly about the polls. What do they tell us about how Israelis are thinking right now? Before this coalition formed, was Benjamin Netanyahu on track for another win?
So I think the polls are very inconclusive. Netanyahu and his party were consistently for the past year and a half, I would say, been polling as, you know, him being seen as the best candidate for prime minister. And then in the actual election polls, because in Israel you vote for a party, not a person, his Likud party was consistently the biggest party. However, it's a system where you have to build coalitions because nobody ever gets a majority. He almost never gets an actual majority that's made up of the current parties and his current coalition. So he would have to like branch out of the religious and right-wing parties to get a majority. And it's very uncertain that he could do that. I mean, he has not been able to do that in a decade, really.
Benjamin Netanyahu has been in office for most of the past 17 years. What's his personal popularity rating like at the moment?
The polls that I've seen have put him head to head with other potential prime ministerial candidates. But in those polls, he gets 40 to 44%. That's higher than the other candidates. So like there isn't anybody out there right now who the majority of Israelis support, but a plurality still support him. Now, part of it is because the field opposing him is very divided. And so that was sort of what Lapid and Bennett were trying to do here, is to try to unite the field, or at least, you know, unite it more, make it less divided than it was against Netanyahu.
What impact do you think the wars in Iran and in Lebanon have had on the politics of Israel? Has the ordinary business of governing the country felt like it's been on hold?
To go back to the polls a little bit, you don't see a lot of movement between the pro-Netanyahu bloc and the anti-Netanyahu bloc, which is interesting. So you would think the war in Iran has gone pretty well for Israel, and Hezbollah is a lot more inconclusive right now. But you would think that those things would strengthen Netanyahu, but it's really an internal game within right-wing votes. Nothing's sort of moving people around from side to side. And part of that, I think, does have to do with internal things. Israel's economy is doing very well on the macro level, but on the micro level, prices have gone up, salaries are somewhat stagnant, unemployment is low, so that's good. But people are not the happiest about the economy right now, for example. Children are out of school for 6 weeks because of the war with Iran, so there's a lot of frustration about education and the education system. Like if you think back to COVID times, you can relate. So there's definitely a lot of domestic dissatisfaction, but you still don't really see in the polls people moving from right to left or left to right.
Lahav Harkov, thanks for joining me for PM.
Thank you.
And Israeli journalist Lahav Harkov is the senior political correspondent for the Washington-based digital news outlet Jewish Insider. Flood levies are supposed to reduce the impact of floods, but fruit and vegetable producers in Western Australia's Gascoyne region say the flooding that occurred in March in the wake of Tropical Cyclone Narelle was made worse by levee banks. The Category 2 system tore through the town of Carnarvon, which is about 900 kilometres north of Perth. Rachel Hagen prepared this report.
We were in the middle of picking those chilies there, and then the flood came in and they ruined it all.
Johnny Lam and his mum Yang Tran are taking me on their buggy for a tour of their plantation.
We'll try to salvage it, but most of it we'll probably throw away.
This plantation in the WA town of Carnarvon was one of the hardest hit by flooding from the Gascoyne River. Cyclone Narelle and the floodwaters that followed caused at least $25 million worth of damage to growers in the food bowl.
Yeah, so you spent about $50,000 on new seedlings at that time.
Yeah.
Did any of them make it?
Everything's dead.
Everything's gone? What kind of crops had you planted?
Watermelon, chili, capsicum.
You have a lake on your property at the moment. Has that happened before with the flooding?
Yes,
it's happened before.
Yeah.
On that 2010 floods, the same thing happened where it just flooded and it stayed for ages.
When floods devastated the Gascoyne region in 2010, Johnny Lam and Yang Tran couldn't plant for a year, and it took 6 to 7 years to fully recover. After those floods, the WA government constructed a 16-kilometre flood levee system designed to protect the town. But Carnarvon Growers Association President Phil Frizzop says this has caused floodwaters to be funneled onto the northwestern properties, including his own plantation. The majority of his ground crops have been wiped out.
They should know exactly what's going on now, so we should be able to get some form of support for the damage that's been done by previous governments. And someone's got to be held accountable. The levees didn't grow there by themselves. No one planted the seed in the ground and the levee grew. Right. I thought the whole idea was to protect everybody, not just to protect a certain amount of the community.
Carnarvon Shire President Eddie Smith says he doesn't know how the issue will be resolved.
I think the flood mitigation works that was done for all the right reasons, to protect the town, the entire town. The levee system currently protects the greater majority of the plantation industry, but there is areas that are unfortunately impacted probably a little bit worse than the expectation was.
But he doesn't think more levies are the answer.
Personally, I'd be lobbying the government to investigate options on how to reduce the impact overall. And that may be having a diversion channel upstream. I don't know. That has been discussed, but there's thoughts there's a massive cost to that that would then also may shift the main flow of the river, which would impact the aquifer here.
In a statement, WA Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis says the levees have performed in line with modelling, but she acknowledges there was flooding on the northwestern side that has impacted plantations. She says the government will continue to assess the impacts and work with landholders on recovery efforts.
Rachel Hagen reporting from Carnarvon, and you can watch more of that story on Landline this Sunday on ABC TV. The future of LIV Golf is in serious doubt after Saudi Arabia announced it was pulling funding from the global tournament. The nation's sovereign wealth fund has pumped billions of dollars into the startup golf tour, luring big names from traditional tournaments to disrupt the sport. There's an impact in South Australia too, where a $45 million development linked to LIV Golf now hangs in the balance. Angus Randall reports.
It was supposed to shake up golf's stuffy image, but just 4 years after LIV Golf arrived with a bang, major funder Saudi Arabia is pulling the pin. Grant Dodd is a golf broadcaster and former pro.
The bottomless pockets of Saudi Arabia perhaps being tested in this instance.
Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, which makes financial decisions on behalf of the Saudi government and royal family, says the substantial long-term investment into LIV Golf is no longer consistent with its current strategy. It's believed to have spent more than $7 billion on the tour since 2022. LIV Golf is hopeful it can find sponsorship elsewhere, but it's a lot of cash. And Grant Dodd says golfers who left the traditional tours to join LIV may not stick around through the transition.
The strength of the tour was the names they had at their disposal, and whether they will stay on without the original premise, what their contracts dictate, no one really knows.
It's put the South Australian government in a tough position. SA was one of the biggest early backers of LIV Golf, first hosting an event in 2023. Works began this week on a $45 million state-funded redevelopment of the North Adelaide Golf Course, which was expecting to host LIV Golf from 2028. Premier Peter Malinauskas says despite the Saudi funding withdrawal, LIV Golf's leaders have told him they plan to keep hosting an event in Adelaide.
They certainly are working around the clock to make sure they continue on into the future. And as far as South Australia is concerned, particularly given the unqualified success this event has been economically for our state, that's a good thing.
More than 500 trees are due to be chopped down as part of the North Adelaide works. Greens State Upper House member Robert Sims says there's still time to change course and spend the money elsewhere.
The business case for this redevelopment has totally evaporated.
But the SA Premier says the trees won't be chopped down for a while and other works are going ahead for now.
We'd be putting the cart before the horse if we just sort of decided to cancel the golf course when we very much intend to be here into the future. Now, let's wait and see how that plays out, like I said.
The Saudi Public Investment Fund is estimated to be worth $1.25 trillion, so the billions poured into LIV Golf are ultimately a small percentage of the available funds. Hans Westerbeek is a professor of international sports business at Victoria University. He believes Saudi Arabia's real goal was to take control over the sport.
Trying to create a powerful position as a nation and as an investment fund that would basically dominate the decision-making in world golf. It really was a power game, as far as I can see it.
He believes there is a place for LIV Golf on the sports calendar, but without Saudi money, it will need to find its niche to stay alive.
If you take that subsidy away, whatever remains is going to be a whole different ballgame, excuse the pun, that will definitely not be able to rival the PGA. It might be a smaller league where, you know, people go to the golf for different reasons, you know, to, you know, drink a lot and throw cups at players when they hit a hole in one. But in my view, it will never rival the traditional format of the game in the way that was intended.
LIV Golf's 2026 season ends in Michigan in the United States in August.
Angus Randall reporting, and that's PM for this week. PM's producer is John Stewart, technical production by Joram Toth and David Sargent. I'm Rachel Mealy. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. In the past week, Donald Trump's obsession with his grand ballroom has reared its head again. He was even talking about it after a suspected third attempt on his life. Today, Dan Diamond, White House reporter at the Washington Post, on legal efforts to stop the president and what Trump's motives really are. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.